are listening to a podcast of The View, brought to you by the Church of the Larger Fellowship. To subscribe to this podcast, visit questformeaning.org or search for Church of the Larger Fellowship in the iTunes store.
That I fled snowy Minnesota and I'm spending the month in Mexico right now, Mexico City, and it is a great place. Did you know it's bigger than New York City, like much bigger? I didn't. It's amazing. I totally recommend it to everybody if you're looking for a vacation spot. And Michael Tino, how are you today?
I'm doing pretty well, thanks, Meg. This is Michael Tino joining you from Peekskill, New York, where it is cold, wet, rainy spring, but April showers bring May flowers, and I'm taking the long view. Good to be with you, Aisha. How are you?
Hi, it's Aisha Hauser. I'm in Seattle. I'm good. We have tulips going crazy here, so while it's gray most days, it doesn't matter because the tulips are so bright and sunny and beautiful, and I am back from being on the East Coast for just over 10 days. I was in New York City, Boston, and Nashua, New Hampshire. So I'm back here now in Seattle.
So Aisha, your local business, your local coffee shop there, Starbucks, has been in the news a lot lately. What do you make of it? What are the people around you making of it? Is it different being there?
Yeah, well, so the world headquarters for Starbucks is here in Seattle, and one of the folks who works for their corporate office is a congregant at the church where I serve. So I actually haven't had a chance to talk to him yet about this, but so the big thing for me is, those of you who are familiar with the book that we've mentioned quite a few times here, Stamped from the Beginning, Ibram Kendi's book, and what he talks about is changing rules to change hearts and minds, changing policy, changing law. So when Starbucks announced this, we're closing for the day, I'm like, come on, folks, you need to change your policy. You need to make it a rule that you are not going to harass people that are sitting there, that you are, so to me, that they're kind of getting it a little bit ass backwards, thinking that this is going to look good and we need to talk to people. And frankly, I don't even know how this is going to be accomplished. Being diligent, and because see, if they announce they're going to change their policy, they will be admitting they had a nonsense policy to begin with. So that's me. But here, you know, people, Seattle's an interesting place. There are places here where I've seen actually the Starbucks in the city itself. There are homeless people go in and use the bathroom as washrooms, and they're not harassed. So I don't know if it's a regional kind of, somebody said that neighborhood in Philadelphia is completely or is very gentrified, and so it's a different attitude towards folks. However, I think they need to start with changing their policy. That's what I think.
Yeah, I for one am not willing to give them a pass because the store was in Center City, Philadelphia, which is snooty. I think that Ijeoma Oluo had a wonderful column on Medium talking about this, and you know, the point that I got from her article was, you know, this really only, you really only make lasting change when you change the white supremacy that's at the structure, at the base, at the, you know, that's embedded in the organization from day one. So changing policies is a good way to get at that. I think that's probably why that works. But I think that they really need to do some examination of corporate culture and who and why they exist, you know, who they exist for and why they exist. Because I think if they're going to be a snooty coffee shop, then they're going to have racist incidents happening in their snooty coffee shops all over the place. And that's not only how customers are treated, but how employees are treated. Because let's be clear, many of the 170,000 or whatever it is people who work for Starbucks are people of color, making, you know, very close to minimum wage. So it's also how their employees are treated. Now, I don't think a day of, you know, racial bias training is going to hurt anything. It's not going to solve the root causes of what's going on.
I actually wonder about that. Because I think the potential damage is folks thinking something happened, While maybe, you know, some folks who haven't done any of this work will be aware a teeny weeny bit. I don't know if that's bad, because I don't know if folks then come out with like, everybody gets a cookie because you did this for the day. So I mean, it can't hurt. That's probably true. But I wonder if actually things like these kind of publicity stunts do more damage than not. I don't know.
Well, Aisha, that's why I thought of you, not only because you're from Seattle, but because you and Christina and Kenny were the originators of the white supremacy teach-in, which in a way was the UU equivalent of this Starbucks day of training, right? So I'm curious if you see that actually moved us forward, brought on, didn't help, as you just said, or made people feel bad?
Yeah, I think they're different. And here's why. Starbucks doesn't pretend to be this organization that's trying to live out values of justice. They want to make money. They crush small coffee shops. They just want to, you know, basically live out capitalism in its extreme, like Amazon, which is also here, like all the other places, you know. So I the values of Starbucks, it would be great if they were anti-racist and didn't treat their workers like crap and their customers who aren't white like crap. Unitarian Universalism is a faith that espouses to be rooted in the affirmation of, you know, the worth and dignity of every person, the independent web of life. So lifting that up in terms of how that's been distorted, our values through white supremacy culture, I think is different. And the teach-in people have been still doing teach-ins, and since we're all volunteers to that teach-in movement, we haven't updated the website yet, but we are going to say to people, like, just put it in your rotation for next year, once in the fall, once in the spring, and continue to talk about it. So I don't think it's the same thing, because it is not one conversation. I was just in Nashville last week with Liz Loeb, and we did a decentering whiteness, dismantling white supremacy culture workshop. So because we're asking of the faith is to live out the values we already espouse, Starbucks doesn't have those values. So it's a whole different kind of paradigm shift for Starbucks. Does that make sense?
Thank you. Yes, very much. I love it, actually. That's going to hold me today. I'm really excited that we have two guests today to help us think also about systemic oppression. We've mentioned this before, that Sierra Marie Giraffo, I'm trying to say that right, Gerfeo. I'm going to start over on that. Sierra Marie Gerfeo, who's a nonprofit consultant and intern minister with the UU Christian Fellowship looking at public theology, wrote a very profound thought piece to the people who are in charge of the ministerial credentialing process, the MFC, that we discussed a little bit on the show a while ago and decided that would be a great conversation in general. And then we are joined also by Reverend Teresa Soto, who's a liberation worker in Unitarian Universalism. They most recently were the interim minister in Flint, Michigan, a place where intersectionality couldn't have been more profoundly visible. So we're very excited to have both of you here to talk about these issues. And disability, of course, is intersecting with all of these other issues of oppression that we do. Sierra Marie, let's start with you. You wrote that piece before you saw the MFC, you released it after you saw the MFC. What was that like for you? How's it been since? What kind of response have you gotten? Do you feel like it's had impact? Let's start with that statement, which, by the way, Jessica, who is behind the chalice, will repost that statement over on our Facebook page so that people who haven't had a chance to read it can read it now. Sierra Marie.
Well, and I'll offer the warning too that it is long, so give yourself some time to digest it. Greetings from New Haven, Connecticut, by the way. You know, so many years ago, I was finishing my tenure as director of religious education at the Olympia Unitarian Universalist Congregation in Olympia, Washington, and they started planning for a building expansion. And anybody who has been through that process knows really well how fraught and exciting that kind of a process is. And that's because designing things is not neutral. When we design things, we are imagining not only what we're going to use them for, but who is involved, who's using the things that we're designing. And so we make choices and we set priorities around these imaginings. And so for me, as I was going through, you know, like we humans, we design buildings and we design playgrounds and we design city streets and we design dog parks and all of those things. And we also design systems and processes. And all of those things have involved the imagining of who's present. And so, you know, as I was going through the credentialing process, it was really, really clear to me throughout the process that this has been a process that was designed, that did not have me in mind, did not have the imagination that I would be a minister in our tradition when it was designed. And that's not a simple passive failure of imagination or the invisibility of disabled people in our work. That actually is part of a long history of oppression of disabled people in our communities. And so the reason we did not imagine ministers with disabilities coming through the credentialing process is because we as a community have not imagined that disabled people can be our ministers. And it was really, really important to me, having experienced that in the process, that I begin to unpack that. But that's not really something that I wanted to do. Like that's not something that I considered like part of my ministry or my voice of public theology even. That was like, it was something that I had to do because of what became so apparent to me in this process. So I just started writing what I was experiencing. And that was really cathartic in a lot of ways, because the oppressive systems that operate within our faith community, they can be really faith challenging. And in some ways, it was very clarifying because I wrote several versions. In fact, this version that I sent to David Petit and the Ministerial Credentialing Office is not the final version that I ended up posting online. Because as I went through each version, I became more and more clear about what the issues were, like able to pinpoint exactly what was going on and develop those ideas further. And so it was cathartic and it was clarifying and it was also vulnerable. And it's important to say about vulnerability that being disabled, like disabled folks are rendered vulnerable in our society in a myriad of ways. We're particularly vulnerable to being killed by police, especially people of color. We're particularly vulnerable to being sexually assaulted. We're particularly vulnerable to being murdered or abused by people who are intimately involved in our lives. So this was a labor of vulnerability that I chose to give as a gift to our faith community because I believe so deeply in the promise of our faith community. And it was written with a lot of hope, but it was also written with some like heartbreaking realism at the same time. And I would say about the responses that that's been pretty consistent with the experience. I am grateful. I'm very, very grateful. I cannot say how grateful I am to David Petit for his open-hearted response and just thanking me for my feedback. I was really afraid that I would be gaslighted in this process. And I haven't experienced that directly. I don't know what's happening behind the scenes, but that's kind of the second part of this. It's like one of the things that I felt I needed to emphasize in the document was the importance of transparency and urgency in the process. And I have felt that my document has been received, but the process that, you know, it's been received by has not been transparent to me. And there are changes that could have just been made from day one that I haven't heard anything about. So if they have happened, that's great. It's just not transparent to me. So part of the receipt of this document has been, you know, kind of coming to grips with with the reality that I already kind of knew existed, and then I was like the heartbreaking reality that I was working with as I was writing the document. And so now I'm sort of living in that space. And the other thing that I would say kind of related to that, just briefly, and then I'll let us move on, is just that this, I have really appreciated, there's been a lot of very clear support in this process from several individuals. There has also been a lot of silence. And the document's publication was met with a ton of silence. And that's still something that I'm coming to terms with. That's really difficult. Okay, thank that's you. All I got to say right now.
Thank you. That's a great start. And I really agree that that silence is very hard to navigate, much, much harder than overt stuff. Teresa, were you involved with the crafting of this? Did you read it after it was done? How do you enter that this particular story? And I know that you've been one of the very visible champions and advocates for justice within the larger movement. But I'm curious if you've been involved in this part of the story.
I got to read the statement when it was published to us as a community. And I'm always interested in people experiencing oppression, having their say, and boosting their voices, especially because that's how we know, right? We can't live all the lives for all the experiences, but receiving the information, not as to even what to do next, but just as to say, oh, I'm a witness right now to this particular thing and this particular person, right? I think that's always got to be somewhere that we begin, witnessing and journeying with each other in this specific way. So that was my opportunity. It is my experience as well that the process is very complicated. And I want to add a historical note that sometimes it's easier to talk about things that we're a little further away from. But at 25 Beacon, that's where the interviews used to be held. And if you were going for an interview at 25 Beacon, you would get a letter that said, hey, we understand you might need some accessibility. Please let us know 2 months in advance. I was always wishing we could write a single letter that said, hey, the people with disabilities are on their way, just to let you know. Right? Can we just say that at the outset? We're always on our way? Because part of what we practice then is this idea that if I had known you were coming, I would have unlocked the door. And it's just not okay. We're already on our way all the time. So I'm really grateful for that aspect of Sierra Marie's work and the way that she's willing to use her experience to underscore that we're already always on our way. And when she talks about the changes that could have already happened, this is why. It doesn't cost money. It doesn't cost time a lot of the time. What it costs is attention. So it would be great if we could begin to talk to each other in those terms.
I really appreciated, Sierra Marie, that your piece so clearly separated, here's what it means to put the onus on the individual, and here's what it means for the system to take responsibility for everyone. Can you say more about that part of it? Because I thought, maybe you said everything you had to say. I thought it was very profound. The way that you explain that.
Well, let me be clear that I actually don't have a background in disability studies at all, and this is not this is not an original idea to me, but I can't give you the depth that somebody who had a background in disability studies could give you about that. It's actually the social theory of disability, I think. Basically, the idea is that, just for those who haven't gotten to the paper yet, I'll just do a quick little synopsis. The idea is that if you consider disability sort of an individual issue, what you do is you say, well, okay, so there are people with disabilities who are going to need particular kinds of access, and here's how they need to, you know, sort of do what they need to do to get that kind of access. And the onus of access is then put on people with disabilities. If, on the other hand, you see disability as a social issue, as a systemic issue, what you say is like, the way that we set up our communities in some ways is a cause of problems for a lot of people. And we need to make sure that we're providing accessibility as just a matter of course. Like, we're assuming everybody's in the room. This is, you know, sort of, I know Cindy Beal talks about like the idea of radical inclusion, or I can't remember what exactly the framework is, but it's like you just assume that everybody is coming, as Teresa was saying. So that's kind of the differentiation that I want to make in terms of the process, that the process of ministerial credentialing is designed such that disabilities are treated as an individual problem, and problem in particular, that they are understood as a barrier to effective ministry, that somebody will need to navigate in order to demonstrate their competency in navigating their disability and their ability to overcome that as a barrier to ministry. Another way we could imagine that process is that we provide a process that is as accessible to everyone as we possibly can. And that when people let us know how it is that their disability will be in the room, that we're able to respond to that in a way that makes us curious and interested in joining with them in creating their ministry. That might not have been exactly as clear as it was in my head, but that's basically what I'm outlining. And I think the same things can happen not just in the credentialing process. I think the same things need to happen with things like search processes, board meetings. I mentioned these in my letter. I think the same things need to happen in the way that ministers with disabilities are received in congregations and how we understand their ministries. And it also means that we have to confront some of the things that we believe about disability. Like, some of the things that we believe are about disability are actually harmful and oppressive. So we need to confront some of those beliefs that are unhelpful.
Thank you. Teresa, would you like to say more about that? Is there anything
you would— I really think that it's about a mindset, right? So one of the things that people say to me is, oh, Reverend Soto, you could go from church to church and you could show people how they can be more accessible. And that's an idea. But there's two parts about that. One is that the accessibility comes from relationships. So one of the things is the congregation needs to assume that it's in basic relationship with disability community, right? If they're already knowing that the disabled people are already coming, then it doesn't have to be a surprise. And if you look in the accessibility materials for congregations, one thing you'll see is that it'll say, this is how many cutouts you need to be hospitable, right? And then I go to a place, and one of the things that happened is now we have chairs that hook together. And so I'll be in my wheelchair or in my scooter or have my walker. And at that moment, people will realize there's no cutout. And they'll say, would you like us to move a chair for you? That's better than, we wish that you'd stayed home today. But it's bad in the sense that it's putting me on the spot. I'm a Unitarian Universalist minister. You can sort of put me on the spot for that if you want. But the thing is, it's not about me. It's about all the people that the congregation needs to be in basic relationship with. And so, when a new person comes, you're going to put them on the spot. And that's the opposite of what you meant to do. So the way to skip that problem is to work on your cutout situation. Oh, ribbon cutout, but seating is at a premium. Yes, for everyone. Right? Like, that's not a surprise. I'm not telling you do all the cutouts even. I'm saying be reliable from one and then grow in your relationships. So I think those two things are really easily woven together, that our mindset hasn't been that we need to make sure that our basic welcome is all set. And instead, when Thierry Marie points out the social model is more like, hey, you should get that checked out and we'll see what we can do. Right? As opposed to being ready.
So I have a question, because I have a lot of energy around the ministerial formation process. What would it look like to start to think about dismantling white supremacy culture from the ministerial formation process from the beginning? Just what does that sound like to either of you?
Yeah, it turns out that the more liberal and beautiful an education is, the more expensive it is. I could have stayed in Portland and paid $300 a credit hour for an education where, well, I probably would have had to stay in the closet for 3 years, or at least try. I don't even know what that would look like. But one of the things is at the very outset, the burden of an education is significant. And if we're not willing to support scholarships, alternative pathways, then we're gonna keep reinforcing that capitalist model of education as a product. And one of the things about that is that Malcolm X says that you can't have racism without capitalism. They serve each other, right? So in that way, when we're talking about the beginning, the education is one of the beginning parts. Fortunately, for things like CTE, there are alternatives. That's clinical pastoral education, where you practice a lot of pastoring and connecting skills. A lot of times it's in a hospital, could be in a prison. There are teaching facilities like veterans hospitals where you don't have to pay to go learn. So that's one option. And if we keep thinking about unlinking capitalism and racism, education is going to be one spot that we put our attention.
I want to say one thing about alternatives, though. Maybe you all can help think this through with me. And Teresa, you all can see why Teresa is like one of my favorite public theologians, or if not the favorite, and why I asked Teresa to serve on my internship committee. So I'm trusting that you will help me with this. So here's the thing about alternatives. Reverend Tom Shade, I think, wrote a piece a while back. I can't remember when it was. It was sometime back. And he basically said, we need to have an alternative, like a deacon model, available for folks, because education, ministerial education, is not, an option for everybody. And we need to have some other ways that people can be in ministry. And what I really like about that idea, and part of the reason that this, taking systems of oppression and really intentionally going in and reconstructing systems that decenter systems of oppression, I'm really passionate about that, partly because we need our Unitarian Universalist ministry in all corners. Like, we need our ministers. Like, we need this. And so the more barriers there are in place that are unnecessary, that don't contribute to sort of, the thriving of our ministry, that's problematic, right? So I really appreciate that about what Tom's saying about an alternative. And my other thinking, and why I'm not quite there, like, we just need to have an alternative system, is that what are we doing if we're creating a two-tier system and not dealing with the oppressions in the original system, right? Like, if we don't deal with what's wrong with the original system and we just create an alternative to it, what kind of What kind of justice is that? What kind of ministry making is that? And what? How does that really help us get ministry into all corners?
Can I jump in? I feel like I've said this so many times. We are incredibly unimaginative when it comes to leadership. And I agree, Sierra, 1,000% with you and Teresa, everything you're saying.
I'm sorry, it blipped right when you said we're incredibly
unimaginative.
Maybe it didn't.
Unimaginative when it comes to leadership. And I agree, we need our ministers. And one of the things that I realized the more I have spoken to ministers the last 15 years about, because I looked into the process like, oh, he should be a minister. Because anyone who shows any kind of competency in life is pushed towards ministry. And the process is, to me, I experienced is racked with fear. Fear about passing, you know, getting through each level. Fear about how passing every single thing. And it's like, I am inspired by, I want to be inspired and comforted and held by spiritual leaders. And I don't know how you all are being held. And there's something off about that. I mean, there's something off with this whole process, but the idea that it's so racked with fear is troubling to me at best. So I appreciate, Sierra, what you said, but to create a second system, but keep the first one firmly in place is not solving the challenges that exist.
Thinking about this idea of alternatives, and I'll put that in big scare quotes. You know, if we call things alternatives, with marriage in New Jersey, right? They created an alternative pathway for marriage because they didn't want to give a couple of marriage rights in New Jersey, and what they wound up with was a second class tier of legal relationship. So, you know, it occurs to me that it's more of the same of, oh, if you need some accessibility, let us know. If you need some alternative, let us know and we'll figure something out for you. Rather than saying, okay, how do we build a system that is accessible to everyone right from the beginning? You know, what if the master's degree in divinity was the alternative? I just wonder. So Teresa?
I totally understand that. And so it's having two clergies anyway. The clergy that everyone expects, straight, white, middle-aged, starting to look very sage-ish, right? And then everybody else. So, and then everybody else, I'd put ministers of color, ministers with obvious disabilities, ministers with family relationships that keep them working at less than full time. Anybody who has any of this expression around their ministry that either implicates an identity strongly or expects to be something different than 40 hours of work for 40 hours of pay. I already experienced that as being a clergy. So what would have you created another class? But one of the things is that some people get to minister without a giant school debt. I would be interested in liberating that second model from more of the trappings, but I don't think that the second model would create the trappings.
Teresa, can you talk about, you're in fellowship and I'm just sort of entering into this sphere. So that move from preliminary to final fellowship in ministry and the connection, you know, you make around the sort of the 40-hour work week and all of that, I think is really connected to sort of the next challenge in the process for many of us with disabilities. So would you mind talking a little bit about that?
Sure. So I'm still in preliminary fellowship. I've had one renewal so far. And as far as people's expectations, I can be gentle and generic and say that a congregation can easily say, Well, we don't have a problem with the minister that's disabled. Our chancel has a ramp. We have openers on the doors. We do the things. But the way that cost comes out in the Congress is that all of a sudden, I'm going to say, Reverend Soto, I don't see you in the building that much. It seems like you could probably use ours, right? And when we weigh that against, I'm available by cell phone, by email, by coming in person to the posted hours. And office hours aren't really that much of a thing for a lot of congregations. So I think it's okay to tailor those, but the point being that people would rather see a person in the office, even if they're not going to be there, than have their disabled minister doing their work at home with their feet up, right? And feet up for me is a really big thing around pain management. It's easy to say that you're ready to do that work, and when you have to give up your pre-expectations. And then harder still not to feel like administer because we have to work, right? So for us to untangle some of those work expectations and what work looks like, being accountable in that relationship is sort of like, I haven't let you down. I'm able to deliver my work. I'm able to be with you in relationship. I'm able to be in communication. And sometimes I need my feet up. Sometimes I need a nap on a Thursday afternoon. Sometimes if I'm going to be at church from 2 o'clock to 10 o'clock, you're not going to see me until 1:30, right? Those are the kinds of things that we need to build in, but with care. Because trust comes in. So if I have compassion for my congregation, that they're reshaping their pre-thoughts, and my congregation has compassion for me, that both of us are reshaping our pre-thoughts, then we can work it out, right? So that's some of it for me, is that the renewal doesn't come just from the days passing. It comes from my relationship with the congregation. And if the congregation doesn't have that much practice at reshaping their expectations, it's an uphill kind of experience. Does that make sense?
Yes. And of course, that goes way beyond preliminary fellowship, what you're saying. One of the things, Sierra Marie, that you quoted in your piece was a paragraph from Bill Sinkford talking about the disabled ministers being seen as vulnerable. Regrettably, I can say that CLF reprinted that and put it out. And I read it as an individual narrative of Bill Sinkford. And thankfully, I had a good teacher here, Teresa, to say to me, you might read it that way, but that is part of a very damaging narrative to many people. And very kindly and graciously told me how oppressive I was being, which I really appreciate, because as Teresa said at the beginning, we all have our own life. And unless we witness other people's, we can't know those narratives. And I think for me, one of the things as I wake up more around disability, and I would say it's certainly a place of growth and learning, is that I don't even know the oppressive narratives that I have, just like with white supremacy or anything else, because I've been trained to think of them about me as an individual and people, you know, oh, I'm nice to everyone there, you know, that level of thinking rather than understanding the systemic thinking of that. And so, Teresa, what you're talking about with all of our collective, we're all vulnerable and we all have bodies and needs. And so what you're describing starts with preliminary fellowship, but can you say more about how that extends into ministry, just generally speaking?
the story of, you know, sort of the value of that my disability brings to my ministry. I mean, that's really resonant for me. It's true that to have Sierra Marie as your minister means that things take longer. For me, talking, listening and understanding, writing, those things take longer for me than for other people. So those kinds of things are true. And what's also true is that when Sierra Marie is with you, Sierra Marie is fully present. Because the way that my mind operates, I actually have difficulty tracking things outside of my immediate environment. And so when I'm present, I'm really, really present. And that's a strength in my ministry. Like, that's huge. Actually, that's the core of my ministry, is my presence. So that's one way that being a disabled minister, like that's a value that I bring to the communities that I serve, is my presence. And because if we're thinking about things as, if we're thinking about disability as an individual issue rather than a social issue, we are more likely to focus on sort of the problems that people have to solve and, you know, sort of like, how is disability a barrier? You know, how are you going to work through the fact that it takes you longer to do things? That those are the questions that are going to be really present for us. But if we look at disability as a social issue, we can also look at the way that, number one, making space for me, making time for me actually contributes to conversation. So, in a conversation with me, we can take time to make decisions rather than hurrying. And because we're doing that, we're being more thoughtful. That kind of, when we look at disability under this framework of like, how can we as a culture be as accessible for everyone, make sure everybody gets to the table. Those are the kinds of spaces that start opening up. We're running to the end of our time, but I was thinking about Aisha because I was thinking about you as a religious educator, and I was thinking about, excuse me, you're hearing my dog bark in the background and probably like 15 children in my house right now. But all the neighbor kids are over. What I was going to say is that, you know, when I think about religious education, like in my three different congregations that I served as a religious educator, what was really important to me is that we not look at like, okay, here's the child with disabilities, like, oh, all the work that we have to do to make things accessible. Did we make things accessible? Well, accessibility is really important. So that's important work. And what do we know about this kid and the gifts that they're bringing into this space and how they're going to contribute to our community? That's also really, really important. And so it's not actually just about accessibility for that kid. We're going, oh, well, if we make things more accessible this way, it'll be better for everybody in these ways. And then we can start thinking about also too, hey, look at all these gifts that are coming to the table. And my hope for the future of ministry from my end of things is that I will have a place to use my gifts. I mean, I think my deep desire and my need in my life is the same as everybody else's, which is that I need a place for my gifts. So I'm looking for models that help us, instead of capitalistic models that help us bring everybody to the table and allow their gifts to come into the room.
I'll just lift up something that one of our viewers, Catherine Clarenbach, said. One of our past guests here also talking about your earth-based theology. So many things about how our disabilities benefit our ministries. Yes, yes, yes. And I will say that as I begin to be more of an active learner, and of course I'm dealing with my own walking issues all the time as well, the wisdom and the compassion of some of the bloggers that I read from the disability perspective, which are not your use specific so much as general, are profound about all of us with bodies. I mean, you know, I just think, as you said, when you make it better for somebody, you make it better for everybody. And that's one of my basic theological beliefs. Aisha brought up before about all the fear that permeates formation and how she sees that as a real foundational problem and issue. And I wonder, maybe starting with you, Teresa, if you have a response about how fear fits into all of these things that we're talking about.
There are a couple of things about fear. When we're fearful, we're less likely to be learning. That's one thing. Like there's productive anxiety that can still be productive, but then there's fear, which is counterproductive to learning. So I want to hold that. And then the other thing, about fear is that when we're fearful, it's difficult to bring our whole selves into a process, into a space. If there are certain things that I'm balancing, for example, when the ministerial fellowship committee is asking me questions that I need to balance, like how much am I seen as a disabled minister, and how much will I be seen if I'm seen as a disabled minister, that kind of thing. I'm glad you're with us now. Oh my goodness. It's so good to have you back. Teresa. So when we're balancing all of that, then we're not bringing our whole selves in. And, I think there are a lot of people who have proposed entirely different processes. Like what if the people who were actually, making decisions about the future of our ministries were people who knew us and were working with us on the ground and who had accompanied us and whose job it was to sort of bring into, oh no, Teresa's gone, to bring into the process all of our gifts, people whose job it was to help us recognize and cultivate those gifts. I can still be dealing with my shortcomings in a process like that, but in relationship with people. I mean, so here's one of the things. In my ministerial credentialing process, something that was a critique that was made about me as the minister by the ministerial fellowshipping committee is that I am not willing to be vulnerable and heartful with people. So this was said by the Ministerial Fellowshipping Committee, and I actually have a job that I now have to complete as related to that. But here's the funny thing. Nobody who knows me would ever say that about me. And one of the ways that they tested to find out, because they knew they had this concern, because it's also how I came off at the religious or the RSCC meeting, that previously there was these regional meetings that were like pre-MFC meetings, and I had gone through one of them, and I came off it, I guess, as being like intellectual and not willing to be heartful and emotionally vulnerable with people. And so they already had that concern, the MFC did. So the way that they tested that with me, like the way they kind of experimented with that, was to have the psychologist in the room ask me a question about how I felt about that happened years ago when I was 16 years old. And now, you normally ask somebody about a big life event like that, that would be like, okay, there's a lot they're going to balance in answering that question, especially if it's a trauma, which it wasn't in this case. It wasn't a trauma. You know, there's a lot that people can be balancing as they're answering that question. But in my case, what was really funny about that is I don't even remember that period of my life very well, because that's the way my disability works. I don't remember details over. And so to ask me how I felt, like, it took me, first of all, three times asking myself that question after the meeting to realize that that's what they were asking me, because I didn't have a lot of time to hear and respond to the questions. And second of all, then I also had to try to remember the details of what happened and how I felt about it. And like, just to be able to access that would take a lot of time for me. That's how my disability was present in the room. So I guess what I'm saying is that, like, we get a distorted picture of people in this process. And my example as somebody who's disabled is like one, sort of poignant example of that, but that happens all of the time in the process. And I think if we can have a process that is not a fearful one, that is an open one where we're dealing with people's growing edges, but we're also dealing with them in the context of relationship and people who are supporting the gifts of the development of the gifts of the minister, then we're looking at a whole different kinds of things, and we won't get so many distortions.
I think that's right. And I think how that continues to work in the fellowshipping process is that as I approach congregations, say, hey, I'd really love to be your minister. They're too afraid to ask the question that would take care of their fears. And that looks like, well, Reverend Soto, it sounds like you're not really keen on those office hours. How will we make sure we can get a hold of you? Right? That's a reasonable question, and I have a reasonable answer. But as long as it's a thing that we can't even talk about, then we're never going to be able to meet in the middle in ways that show our best possibility.
Wow. I have to say, I don't know what happened to you when you left, but your sound is great now, Teresa. So is there anything else? Is there anything else you would like to say? Because we can hear you so clearly now.
I'm super grateful for this conversation because it has some technical aspects to it that we can work on as a community. And also because it matters. It matters where we end up, even if we take our time and talk about our feelings and hand out snacks and make sure that everything is, you know, no stone is left unturned, right? We can do that and still end up in a better place.
Amen. We had comments from other people about somebody with high functioning autism who felt rejected but feels accepted at our UU Fellowship. Always glad to hear those stories. And someone with a physical disability who's often asked what it's like to have a vision or mental disability. And you know, what? And I was thinking that so many of the categories of oppression are such gigantic categories of peoples who, unless we listen closely, don't know each other's stories, whether it's Latinx or queer or, you know, there are just so many variations on every one of these. And so, you know, thank you so much for sharing of yourselves, both of you, and for the leadership that you're bringing to the movement around this. It's going to benefit all of us. Next week, we have Leah Hart Landsberg and Marty Keller talking about UU Jewish identity. And thank you so much for being here.
This has been an episode of The View. If you would like to learn more about the CLF, visit questformeaning.org.